Well, this week, I'm going on one of the loveliest coastal walks in the country, the walk from the fishing village of Slade in County Wexford through Churchtown to the wonderful, majestic lighthouse of Hookhead. The lighthouse dates back to the early 13th century and stands out as a beacon on this coastal shore, serving sailors for over 800 years, helping the boats as they negotiate the notorious waters off the south coast of Wexford. Well, joining me to tell me a bit more is Dr. Billy Colfer, a local man with a long association with Hookhead and author of the Hook Peninsula book. We're sitting on the coastline. To the left of us is Slade, the gorgeous village of Slade. And then to the right of us, behind us, is Hookhead. It's a really ancient feel to this part of Ireland.
Well, it has a lot of connections through the centuries, various influences, a lot of the medieval. But certainly the point of the Hook, because of its association with Waterford Harbour, has felt the impact of different historical events. The Hook itself gets its name from the old word meaning a point, which is a hook, a common place name in throughout Europe and America. For example, you have Sandy Hook in New York. The Hook of Holland is a very popular name as well. So the Hook shares this element with many other places.
What exactly defines the Hookhead? I mean, when you talk about the Hook, from where to where are you talking about?
The peninsula is a long neck of land jutting out on the southwest corner of Wexford. The real Hook is the narrow, low-lying headland that you see here. For many other purposes, the general southwest Wexford area is referred to as the Hook area, which would extend up as far as Duncannon, Arthurstown, and across to Wellington Bridge. It would include the lands of the Cistercian abbeys of Dunbrody and Tintern, for example.
And there's a lot of old abbeys around this area, isn't there?
Yes, it was heavily colonised by the church in the medieval period. The three big estates which were established at that time, two Cistercian and one Knights Templar, they formed the basis for the modern infrastructure and the landscape.
Was there any particular reason that they located so heavily down here?
It was with the intention of making Waterford Harbour secure, because by putting the churches in on these large estates, it meant all the land on the east shore of Waterford Harbour was pacified to a large extent, and would have made the security of the harbour more assured. And particularly when you think that the Knights Templar were also established on the west shore of Waterford Harbour, it would seem that this was certainly the idea.
And apart from the abbeys, you have other quite famous landmarks like Loftus Hall, the big haunting house of Loftus Hall, as you come into Slade.
Yes,
here.
Yeah, I think Loftus Hall, after the lighthouse, is probably the best known building in the area. Well, Loftus Hall is a direct descent of the Templars. The Loftuses ended up owning all of the Templar hospitaller lands. So that was one of the medieval estates which then became a lay estate. So the influences of the medieval period have a knock-on right down to the present time.
And then you come into where we are now, and we're sitting on the shoreline here, right beside this tiny fishing village of Slade. It's quite windy today. These seas are known for being dangerous. Presumably this part was just a natural place where it could land.
You can notice here it's quite calm in Slade Bay. And this is the reason Slade is located where it is, because it was the only natural landing place on the peninsula that is also quite sheltered from the prevailing wind. So this was chosen as the natural landing spot. It also has a connection with the Templars, of course, because Slade, the area of Slade, was one of the farms established by the Templar back in the 13th century, and it was given to a family called Laffin, a Norman French family, and they were located here for several centuries, and it's to the Laffins we can attribute the castle.
And we come into Slade, the village itself, just from the coast there on our way up to Churchtown and then to the lighthouse. The harbour itself is amazingly impressive. It's very well designed. The walls are so very thickly made.
There's some wonderful stonework, as you can see, surviving in the road leading to the pier. And all of this was actually built as a famine relief scheme in 1847. The fact that it survived in such good condition shows the quality of the tradesmen at the time. Their blockwork and stonework has survived so well. The first pier was actually built by the Loftus family, this one over here. In 1684, it's recorded that Loftus is building a quay at Slade for fishing boats. Before that, the boats depended on the beach, which was up here. But the estates were very anxious to capitalize on local natural resources, so the fishing industry was an obvious one. So Loftus was trying to add to the income of his estate by providing a fishing quay for the local men. It also gave him the opportunity to import and export to his estate, because that meant he didn't have to pay taxes.
Of course. So. And what you have essentially is a double harbour.
As you can see, these walls are of concrete. They're of a much later date, to create a sanctuary in bad weather for boats inside. The village was developed quite a lot by a guy called William Mansell, who came here in 1685, and he was a bit of an inventor. He established a salt house, salt manufactory, in this old stone building here. It's still known as the salt house.
It's just beside us here, to the right-hand side.
Yeah. See the corbelling on the roof?
You can indeed, if we go into
which
it.
Which is usually associated with the west of Ireland. But because of the scarcity of timber on the headland, the windswept headland, where trees are often killed by the salt and the wind, Mansell used the local limestone, or got his workmen to use the local limestone, because they were obviously skilled in this corbelling technique, to construct the salt house. And he imported rock salt from Cheshire, which he converted to salt in this building by some form of evaporation, we presume. And it lasted for almost a century.
And it reminds you very much of the beehive huts.
Yes.
In the west of Ireland, but obviously much bigger. Yeah. It's beautifully constructed.
Very well built. Again, it's still standing.
And the castle, which is now in front of us, is it still in pretty good condition for such an ancient castle?
It's maintained by the OPW, and that's why it's in such good shape. It's unique in having a tower, the tower house, which would be mid-15th century. The Laffans were able to afford to build a luxurious hall beside the tower house, which is quite unusual. So it's regarded as a transitional building from the tower to the hall. And gradually then the hall assumed more importance, and later houses did away with the tower.
With the traditional slits all the way through the walls as well.
Defensive features. The Laffans didn't have a lot of land. In fact, their estate here wouldn't have been more than 150 acres, which was quite small. But their position on the sea gave them the chance to have extra income. Now, whether that was from fishing, piracy, or a bit of both, we don't know. It's quite possible also that they got a lot of income from allowing foreign ships to salt or cure their fish.
Yeah.
Because that was the case in the west of Ireland, where the Gaelic chieftains charged the foreign fishermen to cure their fishing, their catch on their land. So it's possible that Mansell was doing the same here.
We've come to Churchtown on our way to Hookhead, and Billy, we're at the site of the Welsh monk De Vaughan, who came here instead of a monastery.
Tradition tells us, and it's also recorded in various genealogies of the saints and so on. We've walked about, I suppose, a mile and a half, I'm still talking in miles, from Slade.
That's a good thing.
Right across to the other side of the Hook.
And behind us we have this view of Waterford
Harbour.
Yes.
Right up to the meeting of the shore and the Nore and the Barrow. When De Vaughan came from Wales, apparently looking for solitude, he also picked a very picturesque location. According to analysis by the OPW, it consists of the early Christian building in the middle. It has later extensions to the east and to the west. The building as we see it now is a composite structure.
De Vaughan came here for some solitude and to set up this monastery here.
The monastery that he established survived right down to the coming of the Normans. It must have been quite an impressive foundation at the time. You can see various little features that tell us that it was an early Christian structure. The round shape in the top of the gap that was broken through to the later extension.
Yes.
This reflects the early Christian window, which was in that position.
The stonework here, as it was down in Slade, would be limestone because that's the stone of the area.
Well, most you see the odd old red sandstone you see here, but that is also a local stone. If you go up a few miles up the road, you get the old red sandstone. There's an odd exotic bit of stone. See the broken font, the holy water font, just here?
A sort of yellow
this
colour.
This is a yellow sandstone called Dundry stone, which is imported from Bristol. A lot of this was imported for the Cistercian abbeys and so on. So this is obviously a bit they managed to acquire for this little church.
And that's interesting because Bristol, Bath, the Cotswolds has that very traditional yellow stone.
Yes, this is it, yeah.
And is there an indication of how long Devon stayed here, St. Devon?
We don't have a record of his death, but if 5th century, his monks, I presume, took over after that and the place kept ticking over. One interesting tradition associated with Devon is the establishing of a fire beacon at the point of the Hook, as a warning to shipping, and presumably in bad weather it would hardly be burning all the time. But this is persists as a tradition that he established, I suppose, as a practical way of showing his exercising his Christianity, that he would warn sailors of the danger of the headland. At least the tradition of lightkeeping has gone back to the 5th century.
And as we spoke about before, a huge connection to the sea.
Devon came by sea, so this emphasises the importance of the sea as a means of communication, you know, and the Templars came by sea. So many of the influences that shaped the present landscape would have been seaborne.
Billy, we've come around the corner from Churchtown and we see in front of us this incredible view of the lighthouse. It's very distinctive looking.
I suppose it's really an iconic presence, not just on the headland here, but for the southeast and County Wexford. It's incorporated into the crest of County Wexford.
It is very, very old as well, developed around the 13th century, I believe.
The first documentary references to it come from the 1240s, but by that time it was up and running. So it's early 13th century. To coincide with the development of the southeast by the Anglo-Normans, and in particular the Earl of Pembroke, William Marshall, who was the lord of all of Leinster at the time. Marshall would have been familiar with the concept of a lighthouse because he had been on crusade up the Mediterranean, so he would have seen at first hand how they operated. He also had the technology, he had the workers building castles and churches. So all he needed to do was to adapt one of his circular castle structures as a light tower to guide shipping up the harbour to his port of New Ross, which he had recently established.
With the building of the Hook Head Lighthouse, who would have advised where they should be positioned and the actual functioning of the lighthouse itself?
The relationship between the headland and the sea would have dictated the position of the lighthouse. The very flat nature of the headland makes it literally invisible if you're maybe 5, 6, 7 miles out to sea. So it wasn't just as a light tower, but also as a mark to show the extremity of the peninsula. A landmark as well as a light tower.
Yes, I mean, it's a very natural place to put a lighthouse because, as you say, it guides the ships in behind us.
Yeah.
To the harbour you can see here and then up to New Ross.
Well, if anything emphasises the importance of the harbour as a trade route in the medieval period and ever since, at the time of the Spanish Armada, its importance was emphasised by the construction of Duncannon Fort. So you have a series of initiatives over the centuries related to the busy shipping lane of Waterford Harbour.
And the harbour is enormous. I mean, it's funny when you look at it on a map, it doesn't look as big, but here you can see the opening and we've got the lighthouse to the left and this huge mouth of the harbour in front of us.
The traditional mouth of the harbour, or the boundary of the harbour, was from Hookhead to Redhead, which is just across here south of Dunmore East, which
just
you can
opposite
see.
Opposite us.
When ships carrying a cargo crossed that line, they were liable for custom dues. It was an economic line as well as an actual line. It was also an avenue for people to leave the country. You know, and many emigrants left the southeast from Waterford Harbour.
It's a good point to bring in Dr. Kevin Whelan, Professor Kevin Whelan of Notre Dame University. And Kevin, the exodus of people would have linked into the exodus of people to Newfoundland, and there's a big connection between this area and Newfoundland.
Indeed there is. We've already talked about the connection with the West Country in England, with the Port of Bristol in particular, because once you leave the harbour here of Waterford, it's very easy to get across to Bristol, and in a way the southeast of Ireland and the southwest of England formed one cultural unit for much of the medieval and early modern period. And then it was from Bristol that the Newfoundland fishery was first prosecuted, when cod became the poor man's beef and a very consistent and high quality source of protein. And they used to say off the fishing banks of Newfoundland that you could literally drop a basket in the water and pull it up and it'd be full of cod. It was such a prolific breeding ground, where the cold water of the Labrador Current met some of the warm waters coming up from the Gulf of Mexico and whatever. So one of the richest fishing grounds in the world, which was first pioneered, as I say, from the West Country in England. But then in the 17th to 18th century, the Bristol merchants discovered they could get both food and men to fish much cheaper here in the southeast of Ireland, in the Waterford Harbour area, than they could in the West Country in England. So they began to take both the provisions and the men from this area here. What we have to understand is, in the Hook, the people in the Hook have salt water rather than blood coursing through their veins. These are all expert fishermen, very used to boats, very used to tides, winds and whatever. So they could take very easily to the fishing kind of lifestyle of Newfoundland. So there was a kind of a natural fit between the culture here and what was required out there.
And what you find over there is that people in Newfoundland have a very strange Irish accent as well.
Well, when I lived in Newfoundland, nobody from outside Newfoundland used to believe it when I said I wasn't from Newfoundland, because my accent as a Wexford accent was so similar to what they had there. And in a way, Newfoundland is, especially the Irish parts of it, like the Avalon Peninsula, it's the 33rd county of Ireland, and they're very strongly Irish in any way you can kind of think of. But the Hook was a great source of both fishermen and also sailors, men who were really, really good at the maritime kind of skills, and that's deeply embedded to the present day in the Hook. When we look at the sea, we tend to see a featureless kind of horizon, but somebody who's bred and born to the sea sees it completely different. They know all the fishing grounds, the mark, the navigation. They're intensely aware of what direction the wind is blowing, what state the tide is in, and the pulse and the rhythm of the sea, and even the seasonality in the year as the fishing cycle goes through. That's something which will be much more familiar to them. These are amphibious people. They have one foot in the land and one foot in the sea.
Absolutely.
And that's a powerful presence in the Hook Peninsula to the present day.
And you speak of the cheap labour that was available then. When did that first start in this particular area?
Well, it would have started in the late 17th century, and originally it was what was called a migratory fishery. That is, it went out for maybe 3 months, fished during the good weather during the summer, and then came back in the winter, because Newfoundland is very far north and is an extremely harsh and rather desolate winter setting. Now, gradually then, they began to understand how to farm and how to kind of set up there. So from the mid-18th century, they actually began to settle permanently there. And the Newfoundland outports, the very distinctive villages that they have there, began to develop from the mid-18th century onward. And then the high point of the migration would have been from the late 18th century up to about 1815. There is still really a very close link between the southeast here and Newfoundland, and there's been a good deal of back and forth in recent years and the re-establishment of the linkages, which is appropriate because the sea here has always been something which brought people together rather than divided them.
It is particularly unusual to have such emigration in pre-famine times in Ireland.
Yes,
presumably there would have been a point at which ships were just bringing people out all the time.
Yes,
here.
Yes, absolutely, and the fleet went out as one big kind of fleet. You could have had anything up to 100 of these big sailing ships, like say the replica one, the Dunbrody, which is now moored off New Ross. But you might have had 100 of those hold up here in the deep water up around the passage in that area, and then they would have been loading up their provisions, loading up their fishing gear, and also recruiting the fishermen who would actually go out, you know. So it must have been an amazing sight when a fleet of that size began to pass out here, through the harbour here every spring, you know.
Billy, as Kevin says, it does link into the sort of innate instincts people around here would have had traditionally.
Completely, because obviously they depended on the sea for, if not all of their food, but certainly for a lot of it. I remember as a child salting pollock and mackerel during the summer with my grandmother. You had a barrel or a half barrel of each fish, and that was called on right throughout the winter. And not only the sea itself, but the seashore was of huge importance. because the people who didn't have access to fishing, to a boat, I mean, you need a basic equipment to catch fish, nets or lines in a boat, so they could fish from the shore. So fishing from the shore was of huge importance, carried out religiously by the people. They had homemade fishing lures made from goat hair, for example, or pigskin. They were self-sufficient from that point of view. Also, they picked peahons, which were periwinkles, or barnocks, which were the limpets, and these were fed to humans and to ducks as well. But all of this led to a detailed naming of the seashore, so that each rock, each inlet, or chans as they're called locally, had its own particular name, some of them quite bizarre, but they're the names that were given to them.
Earlier in the series, I did a programme in the Glenties of a very similar project, naming all the different rocks and inlets, all the old Irish names.
And even here, although it would be regarded as an English part of Ireland, I think something like 30% of the names are in Irish. So it shows that they have deep origins in history.
I mean, what's interesting, Kevin, also is the fact that this does seem to be quite an international little part of Ireland in many ways.
Yeah, because that's the paradox of the Hook, is isolation by land. You're coming literally to a point, and once you go to the Hook Lighthouse, you can't go any farther unless you can walk on water. But the isolation by land, but linkage by sea, and lots of the people here, like Billy's father was a sailor and would have sailed in the seven seas, and lots of people here had experience of international deep water, you know, maritime kind of activity. But then when they were here, they might move like 5 miles up the road, and somewhere like Salt Mills or whatever might seem to be a very foreign territory. And when I came down here first, like, you know, the people up the country in Wexford, they used to always say that the people in the Hook called the people inland the Baltadors, which, you know, or Baltadors, which meant that the people inland used to literally bolt their doors at night, whereas the people in the Hook used to do that because they might be called on to, you know, say, rescue somebody who was lost at sea or whatever, and the doors were kind of left open at night. So the Hookers, as they were called up there, you know, they were always seen as being very localistic, almost very tribalistic, but and also had this kind of link to the sea. But it's a paradox of isolation, almost, in terms of, if you look at it from the land, but this wide range of reference if you look at it from the point of view of the sea.
Very much. And if you, as you said, this iconic view of the lighthouse itself,
it's almost a badge of identity for the headland, you know, and it's visible from the headland. Is so low-lying, the lighthouse is ever present, and even if you're a distance from the Hook, you can still see the flash. The local people would have had, I suppose, a subliminal attachment to being close to the lighthouse.
And again, I think a very distinctive part of the personality of the Hook is that you have these three elements. You have the land, you have the sea, but the other thing you have is the sky, which is probably the thing that we in Ireland take most for granted, and which is one of the most distinctive things here. Like, you have a very dynamic sky. You know, you have the wind, it's changing in colour. You've got this vast drama kind of across your head all the day. It's never the same 2 days running. And there's an old Irish poem, in 8th century poem, which talks about the mirror lost, the nav gal, and on Talaf Cay, you know, the beautiful sea, the changing sky, and the eternal land. Yes. And I've always thought that was a good summation of somewhere like the Hook. Mm. It's enormously beautiful, and it's never the same 2 days running. In some respects, it's at its most spectacular and most beautiful, maybe after a winter storm. So if you're down here, saying in January or whatever, when you have the very dark kind of headland, but then it's necklaced with the kind of foam, and you've got these big seas, you've got this wonderful sky over you, and you've just got this very kind of cleansed or rinsed look to the whole thing. There's a kind of an addictive quality to the light.
A lot of people are in fact attracted here by storm, prepared to get rust on their cars and drive through the spray up to the very point to experience the majesty of the sea and the foam covering the roads.
And I've been here when there has been a ferocious storm one winter, and it is an amazingly majestic sight to see. It's overpowering.
It envelops the headland because the headland is so low-lying. I mean, I can sit in my study and watch the foam being blown past my window, you know. The whole headland is very quickly under the influence of the sea.
It's a distinctive little world on its own. It's what the French would call a pays, a little cultural unit, which is its own distinctive identity, rooted in the relationship between culture, history, and environment. But it's also just an extremely beautiful place, and a place that the more you come to, the more you fall in love with.
That programme was first broadcast on the 26th of August, 2005. Shanks Mare was presented and produced by Ella McSweeney. Well, next week, Ella visits Corrafin in County Clare to walk with Ireland's only cave archaeologist. That's Dr. Marion Dowd, who has dug up some incredible remains.